Welcome to the Bill Bennett Show. Welcome back, folks. Thoughtful conversation about the news of the day, and we address existential threats to America. And they're both internal and external, those threats. We'll talk about them with two very smart guys. Joining me today, Conrad Black, an author, columnist, and media contributor. Also, Victor Davis Hanson. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute. His focus is classics and military history. This is a special edition of the Bill Bennett Show. We call it Scholars and Sense. S-C-H-O-L-A-R and S-E-N-S-E, Scholars and Sense. Let's jump right in. Guys, I am, when I wrote my American history book, I talked about 60s and 68 as the annus horribilis. Am I saying that right, Victor?
Close enough.
Yeah, we don't really spoke, Victor. You know, I'm not sure how they pronounce these words. Anyway.
And how do you actually?
There's a Catholic pronunciation that's different than...
I am guilty of that, but how do you say it?
Terribilis. There even people have used terribilis, but horribilis is the normal one.
The contemporary use of it was Her Late Majesty the Queen, and that she pronounced it just as you did, Victor.
It was a horrible year.
Yeah.
But I was worried about the country then and people spelling America with a K. But I'm more worried now. I don't know where to start. Can we start with this election, this last election?
Can I just say, Bill, I agree with you completely. I mean, I'm not an American, but I care about America. I feel very discouraged about what's going on, although I see hope. But in 68, I remember it well, and as we all do. And it was a terrible year, but we should all remember in that year, at one time or another, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Robert Kennedy, Nelson Rockefeller, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan were all running for president. I mean, then they were all qualified to be president, and some of them were presidents and good presidents. And it's not the same now.
Yeah, I think the big difference is in 68, the protesters were outside the Pentagon, or they were walking into the trying to block the president's desk at a university, or they were shouting at the corporation. Now they're in the corporate boardroom, they're running the Pentagon, and they're running the universities.
You know, they had pretty much control of the media in those days, but now they've got, as you said the other day, Victor, they got everything except the people. And the people look pretty wobbly on election day, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the people. What happened there? Let me start with this. I talked to one candidate for the Senate who came very close to winning. And he said, people turned out, but they didn't turn out like they did for the Democrats because the Democrats know how to do this. And by the time my voters got to the polls on election day, I was already down 150,000, 200,000 votes. I said, was it dishonest? I said, no, I don't think necessarily dishonest or fraudulent. They got these mail-in things and they've got 10,000 union workers across the state. And they were hustling. And we don't have that kind of army. Was that it, guys? Was that what happened?
Yeah, I'd say it's half and half. I mean, obviously, the Democrats are better at this new type of electioneering where half the votes come in well ahead of election day. And then they were assisted, I think, by McConnell holding back the funds he controlled until late in the campaign, and in Alaska contributing to the non-official Republican candidate. But the other half, I am afraid, is that the Democrats managed with this nonsense about characters on the ballot, democracy's on the ballot. A vote for Trump is a vote for violence and chaos, even though Trump wasn't a candidate. And they use that, and it's rubbish. It's an absolute canard and a defamation, technically. I mean, if there wasn't an exclusion for public officials and or public personalities. And yet they made up for the fact that 75% of the people thought the country was going in the wrong direction and almost 60% disapproved of the job Biden was doing. And if they can mobilize that many people in such a spurious thing, I am afraid Trump's finished. I mean, I like him. He's an old friend of mine up to a point. He's been good to me. And I don't desert my friends. Not that my opinion counts for much, but I think he's had it. Unless he can do what he did on the night where he announced his candidacy, where he gave, I thought, an excellent speech, entirely positive, no disparagements of anybody, reform agenda. If he can get to that and stay there, he's got a shot. Otherwise, I think he's riding into the sunset.
I think there were five or six reasons. None of them were determinative in themselves, but altogether, they were force multipliers. And you mentioned one that you think that after 2018 and 2020, the Republicans would have got smart to the idea that 70% of the electorate doesn't vote on Election Day in many states, and they haven't. Then this Act Blue raised $2 billion nationwide. And, you know, Win Red, that's its imitative counterpart, is pathetic. And so they were outraged. Blake Masters and Oz and Herschel Walker, they're outraged 3-4, 5-1. That was one. The other thing you touched on, Conrad, is that they tried to paint the Republicans as semi-fascist, nihilist, un-American. And to dispel that smear, they should have had a positive Gingrich-like contract with America, but it was all, this is what's wrong with Biden, but here's what we're going to do in the first 100 days to the extent we can on inflation, the border, crime, energy, and they didn't really spell that out. Kevin McCarthy tried, but not very, and Mitch McConnell didn't do it at all. And then I think in addition to all that, Donald Trump, I don't know why he winked and nodded and before the election said, I'm going to have a big, right as soon as the election's over, I'm going to have a big announcement. That just energized a lot of left-wing people who were kind of dispirited to get out and vote. And I don't know why he attacked DeSantis. That might have turned off a few DeSantis voters.
That was after the election, though, wasn't it?
No. He said sanctimonious right on the eve of the election. Oh. And then in addition to that, we downplayed. I know I did. I thought nobody's going to fall for draining the strategic petroleum reserve for a 10-cent break on a gallon of gas, or marijuana amnesty, or student loan amnesty, or abortion. People are going to die in every alley in America. And they did. That galvanized a lot of young people. Women that were unmarried without children voted about 75% Democrat. So that demagoguery that I think a lot of us downplayed was very effective. And then finally, I don't know what happened to normally reliable polls. If you look at the top 20 polls, Insider mm-hmm. Advantage and Trafalgar were in the top five. And yet Trafalgar had Kerry Lake up by 8 and Oz up by 3 and Blake Masters up by 1. I think there's a lot of complacency where a lot of people thought, well, if I don't turn out, it won't make that much difference because we're going to have a tsunami. That's what everybody had assumed. So there were a lot of screw ups, and I don't know if they're going to be addressed or not. I think you're right about Donald Trump. I don't know if he wants to be president, because so far, when he's had dinner with these two crazy anti-Semites and he's talked about the Constitution in lunatic terms. And then in addition, he made fun of Mitch McConnell's wife in racialist terms. He talked about Youngkin's name sounding Chinese.
Crazy stuff.
King Lear stuff. He's gone to his King Lear mode.
Yeah.
I mean, all he had to do was just say, you know what, this time around, I'm going to talk about the issues, as you pointed out, on his opening announcement, and you're going to get MAGA competence, but without the psychodramas this time. But and all DeSantis has to prove is, I'm a MAGA guy. We know that, but I have fire in the belly. And what's happening is DeSantis says, I took on Disney. I took on critical race theory. I even performanced art and sent illegal aliens to Martha's Vineyard. So I'm Trumpian.
And I didn't take the COVID shutdown.
Yeah. And didn't. Absolutely. I have the Trump agenda, and I have the same fire in the belly, but without the psychodramas. And Trump, to win over the donor class and the independent voter, which he needs, he's got, all he had to do was stick to the issues, as you said, and he didn't do it so far. So I don't know if he's really sincerely wants to win.
He can't pull off a sort of new, you remember, you're referring to his 1968 bill. You remember Nixon ran as the new Nixon, you know, and his slogan was Nixon so bad. It was sort of self-deprecating, and it worked. And he was never down the well as far as Trump was with the left, you know, or the soft left. I mean, no one was really seriously accusing him of being a racist or a warmonger or anything. But if Trump can't do that, I agree with you, Victor. DeSantis just has to sit there and watch him stew in his own juice, and he'll win the primaries.
Yeah.
Let me go back. A question. I was listening to you closely, Victor. You talked about five or six things, force multipliers. On one, you mentioned women, single women, 75% or unmarried women without children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you mention the abortion thing there?
Yeah. I just said that
part of the demagoguery.
They said,
I think that was
women. Women were going to die everywhere. They said it was there. They were going to die.
Package. You mentioned the mob. It was a package of measures very skillfully targeted to young voters. It seemed to me, both men and women.
I saw it on the Stanford campus 6 months before the election or 2 months. Nobody cared. And all of a sudden, there were posters everywhere about abortion rights, student loan amnesties, marijuana amnesties. And that really galvanized 10% of young people who wouldn't have voted out otherwise. So did those Phantom of the Opera speeches that we all laughed at, the semi-fascist, un-American, John Meacham speeches that he wrote.
Isn't that guy a disgrace?
Yeah,
he really is. Yeah. Let me come back to this. There are those who still talk about 40,000 votes, in the last presidential election.
Yes.
Been changed. You talked about several things, Victor, force multipliers. You didn't mention fraud. They can win this without fraud, can't they, doing the things that they did?
They raise that kind of money.
If the Republicans don't raise their game, I would say they could.
Yeah. And do you suspect fraud, dishonesty in the mail ballots or not?
I think if there is. Anytime you have 70% of the votes are not cast on election day, as in a state like California, then there's, I think what's really interesting about how brilliantly or Machiavellian the Democrats were for a whole year, they baited the Republicans with the voter ID issue. Voter suppression, racism. And the Republicans spent a lot of energy, capital, and time saying, no, voter ID is just like casting a check. You know, this is condescending. It's kind of racist in itself. We're going to fight this. They went to court. And the whole time it was like the Democrats had lit the kitchen on fire and the Republicans were trying to battle it. And meanwhile, they walked in the open door of the living room and had what they wanted, because that was the real issue, was mail-in voting and early voting where there is no ID. And 70% of the vote is cast there now. And the Republicans were fighting over the integrity of 30% of the vote. And they should have been talking about vote curing and third party harvesting and same day registration and voting that comes in after the deadline. And they didn't get it. And the Democrats kind of Cheshire cat smile on their face.
But in point on Bill's question, though, do we think that there was anything like the skullduggery in the harvested ballots in this election that there probably was in 2020?
Only to the degree, if Florida can count the ballots and by midnight, and they've got, four times more ballots than Arizona, it takes 3 weeks. I don't know whether it's skullduggery.
I will say
the reason for the question is if there's this fraud, if there's fraud going on, skullduggery, whatever, then even if Republicans improve their game in all the legitimate ways, you still don't win if they're cheating.
Well, you have to go back to, I think they have to go back to 70% of the ballots are cast on election day. And they have to win the state legislature. That's what's so tragic.
Are cast on election day
Day. Yeah, they're cast on election day where you can authenticate the person.
30% or not.
With a voter ID. And I don't know if they can do that.
Well, Trump aside, when Oz stepped in to vote on election day in Pennsylvania, he was already down 350,000 votes.
Yeah.
Or some number like that.
I think
so
Trump
that
was
suggests.
Too.
Yeah. So I guess, sorting this out, A, improve your game, B, go for election integrity. But as I understand it, we lost, I think, all of the Secretary of State elections, or all but one, Republicans.
Yeah, I think we did.
So election integrity, I don't see that coming. I mean, with Pennsylvania disregarded its own rules last time, right? 2020.
Yeah,
and it didn't matter, and our Supreme Court didn't pay attention to it. I guess I'm looking, should I despair or not for 2024?
Well, I think if you look at 2018 and 2020 and 2022, and you see a pattern of even prior to COVID of this non-election day balloting and this asymmetry of fundraising, and it's occurring again and again. There's a problem with the Republican leadership that is ossified, or they have some resistance to change, or they don't understand technology or Silicon Valley's role. I don't know what it is, but if you do it three times in a row, and you still can't figure it out, I don't know how to help them.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Does Ronna McDaniel carry the can for this? Because there's a lot of discussion of changing the DNC chair, isn't there?
Yeah. For RNC. Yeah.
It's hard to know.
RNC.
There's been a lot of criticism of all three of them, McConnell and McCarthy, the three Scots people, McCarthy, McDonald, and McConnell.
McDaniel.
Yeah, McDonald. And I don't know. Kevin McCarthy's never really been in a leadership role, and they did win the House. We'll see what he does. But McConnell, he seemed like he was more interested in being a minority-majority leader than he was in ensuring that he was going to be majority leader. I don't know why
he's full of Trump hate. He's an outright.
Why would you put $10 million in Alaska between two conservative candidates and not put it right in Arizona or Georgia?
Yeah. But let's talk about the country, which is a mess in so many ways now. You know, Title 42 is going away. I mean, I don't know what that means in terms of numbers. And the numbers are already enormous. You know, the overseas stuff with Venezuela. I mean, the craziness. How bad does it have to get before people are not swayed by this demagoguery? I mean, for two more years of this, is that not enough?
Well, look, it really pains me to say this, but I just don't think the Republicans can afford the Trump baggage anymore.
They can't. They can't.
I mean, he's repositioned the party where they can make a strong appeal to the African-Americans and the Hispanics and the working class. Wonderful thing. He got rid of the Clintons and the Bushes, and getting rid of the Clintons was a good thing. I think if the Trump, ball and chain isn't around their ankle, then they seriously study all the things we've just talked about and everything else, and make a maximum effort to match the Democrats in preventing some of this that we've been talking about taking place, I think they've got a good chance, because the Democrats will be very vulnerable on their record. And by the way, I'm one of those who has never believed that Biden would run again. I just cannot believe the Democrats would allow that waxworks dummy to run again. But what the hell do I know?
That's the only good thing about the midterms. They're convinced that he can run again now.
Good.
Well, you look at Florida and DeSantis in Florida, how
amazing.
He won that Hispanic vote in southern Florida overwhelmingly, and all of the statewide offices were won by Republicans. Marco Rubio really was energized by DeSantis's coattails. He won, more than he'd ever had. I know that the demographic changes have helped DeSantis, but he showed that he can appeal to constituencies without, becoming a Romney Republican. And so I thought that that's kind of the model right now. And
boy, it sure is. I agree with Conrad. I'm not as close to President Trump as you are, but I'm pretty close and friendly, and a lot of phone calls. And I thank him for his 4 years, and this country was great.
Yes,
and it was a great presidency in so many ways. In some ways, unfortunate, but in terms of the issues, the policies. Terrific and grateful, but thank you. But step off the stage. Now, that's a big, big issue, big question whether he will. But taking what Conrad said, Victor, do you believe that if Trump stepped off the stage, sort of opened the way to others, and DeSantis is the leading candidate, that we then can overcome what we all stipulated, these massive or at least very large Democrat advantages?
Yeah, I do. But there's two qualifiers to that. When you say step off the stage, does he take his 20-30% of the Republican base with him, or does he say, like he did in Georgia in January?
No, he says, let's assume for the sake of the argument, he says, I get the point. I'm gone. Everybody support Ron DeSantis.
Well, you got a good point. He could be a historical figure if he did that, because what he should say is, I'm going to make sure that my legacy is enshrined by DeSantis. I'm going to be magnanimous, and you're going to look back at my 4 years and contrast it with Biden, and it's going to look better every year. He could do that.
Assuming he does that, is that enough to
feel that Republicans could win? The other qualifier, though, is and I think this is important. I don't think that you'll get that 20 or 30% people if DeSantis says, I'm going to unite the party and Trump's out of the equation, but I've got to tack back to the Bush center and do things. I mean, just not that would be equivalent to what Bush did with Medicare drug prescription or No Child Left Behind or all that stuff. And if he tries to bring back the never Trump donor class or the never Trumpers who want to come back, but they want to come back on their terms. And that is that the party goes back to what it was prior MAGA. And I don't
think Democratic.
Yeah. And then I don't think those people, I know all those people very well in this area, especially they will not turn out for DeSantis if he goes back to a Jeb Bush candidacy.
Stipulate two things. Okay, fine. The second thing, I feel very confident. I know DeSantis well, very well.
Yeah.
I know a few guys do. I don't think he will. I think he is a true conservative. He truly believes what he says and truly is proud of what he has done. And I think deeply respects the job that President Trump did. And I don't think he'll tack back. Well, and I don't think he sees that as a political advantage to tack back.
If he keeps with what he's doing now, he's been brilliant so far. He's been conservative. Yep. He's been feisty, combative, but not combative without being, you know, going down cul-de-sacs and picking spats and all that stuff.
So Trumpism without Trump. Yeah. It's a winning ticket.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is a winning ticket, and you think it wins.
Yeah, I do. I think you can win.
It overcomes all of those things that we talked about in the earlier part. The demagoguery, the mail-in, the harvesting, do we have a counterpart to 10,000 union members scattered all around the state, you know, signing people up? You laugh. Okay.
No, I don't think so.
There are a lot of rank and file Republicans. They're not organized into units like organized labor, but there's basically half the people are Republicans. So you get a lot of volunteers.
All right. So all we got to do is admire Sir Trump, the three of us, is to talk to him and persuade him not to run and go gracefully and have a great legacy. I'm ready to tell him that, but I'm sure others have or tried.
Oh, I think he's not being served well by his staff either.
No,
Let me ask you guys this. I mean, I don't want to overstate the intimacy I have with him. I've known him a long time, reasonably well at times, but obviously I haven't had so much to do with him since he's had this great prominence politically. But my question of you is it not the case if, as he, you know, as time goes by, and he's always polling all the time, and he has been all the time I've known him, going back over 20 years. If he sees he's not making it, I don't think he's just going to conduct a kamikaze raid. I mean, if he sees he's not making it and doesn't see a way for him to get back, I think he will, not out of a huge magnanimity of spirit, but just as a tactical decision of what's best for Donald J. Trump, he'll do something like what Bill said and be the, you know, it's time for new blood, and I I'll support the Republican candidate as long as he espouses the sort of things I'm trying to do.
Now, about that, but I think there's another scenario that we're looking at right now, and that is if you look at the polls today, he's still out polling in the Real Clear Politics DeSantis, but he's not polling as well as DeSantis against Biden. So if he feels that he can get the primary, even though the polls look like he can't beat Biden, it'll be very hard to dissuade him because he'll say, well, just give me the nomination and I can turn things around in the general.
Like you did with
Clinton. Let's straighten this out. Let's see if we're on the same page. Polls I read, and not necessarily inconsistent with what you just said, polls I read that in a field of six or seven, he's the top getter. But it's just DeSantis and Trump. DeSantis is now getting more support.
Yes, but I don't think that's going to – don't you think there's going to be five or six people?
Yeah, no, sure. Mike Pence is going to run and what's her name from South Carolina, and Mike Pompeo, and who knows who else?
Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley, that'll strengthen Trump. But at Conrad's point, you know, and again, we all have to say, but I love the presidency he ran. I love the country he ran. We all have to say this now. Nevertheless, he won't do a kamikaze mission. He's doing one right now. At least a damn good imitation of one.
Yep. Yes.
What do you think he's doing? What's behind this? why
he just needs to I understand more sinned against than sinning. I think that's from that play, right? And my God, has there been a president who's been more sinned against, more lied about?
I think that's part of conspired against. Point. Yeah, I think
drive anybody nuts, right?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think what's happened is these recent disclosures that the FBI was weaponized, and James Baker, the Twitter lawyer, and Twitter was weaponized, and we now know the Wuhan lab was, as Trump said, everything Trump said basically was true. The Wuhan lab was the virus. Right. Anthony Fauci was a partisan. Gain-of-function research was subsidized.
Right.
Comey and the FBI was corrupt. Silicon Valley was corrupt. Hunter's laptop was authentic. Every single thing was true. And I think he's frustrated because he said, I told you all this, and I was Cassandra. Nobody believed me. And
I know.
And that's why I lost the election. And that's not fair. And I want to overturn this. So he doesn't understand. You can't do that.
Mr. President, everything you said, which people criticized and made fun of you for, was right.
Yes.
However, we think you're sort of a madman now, so we're going to say, please don't run. I don't think I got a great argument.
Let me ask you guys this, though. And it looks to me like they're cranking up to indict him. I mean, the Department of Justice is just an arm of the DNC now, I think. And I mean, even Andy McCarthy is sort of a friend of mine. And is a good man, but he admits that it's all political. Yeah. If they indict him, is there any? I mean, will that knock Trump out? That he'll have to fight the legal battles and can't run as president again, or will it actually cause a surge of support for him because people will finally realize how he's been persecuted?
Well, that's the second one is the theory I've heard is that the Democrats know that engender sympathy for Trump. Best thing we can do is indict him. That'll really get the crazies.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they'll indict him, though, because I think people will. I think that while it'll win sympathy for him, like the Mar-a-Lago raid, it will be more. It'll feed this narrative as, oh, my God, I'm tired of all these melodramas.
Yeah,
I know they're after him. I know that. But why does their obsessions with him will go away? I don't not necessarily agree with that if he's away. And so we'll have to start over with DeSantis and he won't give them as much ammunition. But I don't think they're going to indict him because I think as they've watched him the last month or two, they're thinking, why would we want to take out Trump and hand the nomination to DeSantis? Because I think I agree with you. They're so weaponized and political. I don't think they even really disinterested fashion really care about what he did. I think it's all political.
Yes.
If it's politically inopportune for them to take him out, they won't take him out.
Yeah. Let's move to January, not January 6th last, but this coming January. What you just said, Victor, it suggests where I want to lead, which is it looks to me like what can the Republican House do, actually, and is what it's setting out to do. The only thing I've heard primarily is, you know, have hearings on Hunter Biden. Is this the way to go? I mean, I think the Hunter Biden thing is outrageous, horrible. I think the big guy ought to be in jail. But I'm not sure the American people are interested in a bunch of hearings on this. I don't think that's what they want to happen in Washington. Am I wrong?
It depends.
What can they do? What can this Republican House
do? If it was a fair hearing where they, unlike the January 6th committee, there were Democrats on it, and the whole thing was conducted in a sober and impartial way. I think it actually could be useful as long as it wasn't their sole preoccupation. I mean, they've got to do other things in all hearings.
No, but they can't do that. I mean, do you remember the hearings with Hillary on, you know,
Benghazi?
Benghazi. I mean, a lot of our team made these speeches for their, you know, their 5-minute speeches for their own audience at re-election, and it falls apart.
But if they can get a good lawyer and they can get, say, Tony Bobulinski under oath and say,
okay.
This is the reference to Mr. 10% and the big guy. Okay. Who is this person? Can you tell us why you think that is Joe Biden? What evidence do you have to support that assertion? And then they can call Hunter and say, how much money do you think you made? And I think their biggest liability is kind of an Al Capone exposure to tax fraud, because I don't think they reported all this income. And when Joe Biden gives Hunter money, do they pay gift tax on it? Anything over $17,000, unless you call it a phony loan, is subject to 40% gift tax.
Well, you won't, so you won't get, the Justice Department doing anything on their own. So it's just a matter of how much.
But if they can get a dispassionate analysis and get these people to testify, it'll look pretty bad for the Biden family. Yeah. It really
I don't think there's any evidence that government policy under Obama was altered because of money paid to the Biden family. But I agree with you, Victor. I just have a real problem believing that all the taxes were paid as they should have been. And there is this business, I'm getting out of my depth here, but this business of registering as a foreign agent. I mean, I think they're foul of that, at least Hunter is, but and the president's brother. But you know, all the House can do, even with a very fair hearing with the Democrats given a, you know, a full chance, is make that case, because Garland is not going to invite a member of the Biden family, even if there's a gun at his head.
So. All right. So you want hearings, and we hope for the best. Hope it
depends
turn
on who's a committee too. They can't have those guys. You were right on about that. Benghazi. There was a lot. They just gave performance art, blowhard speeches.
Yeah,
we were told that Trey Gowdy was a professional prosecutor, and he was just going to slice up Hillary. And they got one thing out of it. What difference does it make when she said that? That hurt her. Yeah. But other than that, they didn't get into all of the emails where she had been warned, and they had been warned of lack security, and they did not want to beef up security before the election. They should have got them on the idea that they claimed that the attacks were spontaneous and had nothing to do with Al Qaeda. That was a lie. And
it had to do with
the video maker,
patients of Muslims on American television.
Yeah, a video maker, and that was all a lie. But they weren't effective. They were just bloviating. It was counterproductive.
The Bidens are much more of a sitting duck than Hillary.
They are. She's much.
I mean,
better.
They're very vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I hope so. I just hope we do it right. I've been listening to Comer, chairman of the committee, and, you know, his points are great, but he plays a bit to the caricature of Republicans.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to worry about this stuff in an age of TV and all that. And I don't know about Kevin McCarthy. You're the Californian, Victor. I am never persuaded by him. I, when I walk past the TV, I stop when I see you, when I see Tom Cotton, you know, one or two others. It used to always be Trey Gowdy, but you know, I've never been moved or stopped or made to think by anything Kevin McCarthy ever said.
Yeah, I know him, and I'm in a district. I live on a farm that's right near his district in Nunes. It was a great tragedy that Devin Nunes, to work, because he would be right now the chairman. He was of the Ways and Means Committee, which is
Was he your congressman?
Well, he was. I've known him since he's 25 years old.
No, 30. But where you live?
I live. It's a very funny district. It changes every 4 years or every 10. I had David Baldeo, the guy who voted to impeach Trump, that got elected. And then I had Jim Costa, Democrat. Then I had Devin Nunes. So I've gone.
Okay.
But Nunes is the fighter. Yeah. He's smart as hell. He's got a cunning. He understands the left. He's indomitable. Yeah. And had he been in a leadership position, I think it would have been, we would have had a lot of advantages.
What can they do? Can they really do something about what I've heard listed as a priority? 86,000 new IRS agents. Can they do something about that?
Unless they want to shut down the government, they can, and not approve a budget. But their biggest, I think their main thing, they can only do two things. And that is, they've got a majority to call in committees that embarrass the Bidens. And then for all practical purposes, if they have discipline, Joe Biden will never get a piece of legislation through anything for the next 2 years. And he'll have to be like Trump and run by executive order.
Yeah, I think that part's right. But they won't be able to get anything through either, right? They can't get anything passed.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They won't be. The Democrats can't get anything through now. And it's a tragedy. They can't either.
House can't either.
No.
They got to watch what they're saying. Like, I've heard people say, we're going to fix the border. No, you're not. How are you going to do that?
That's why it was so tragic about the Senate. Had they just won those two seats, they could have stopped every appointment. every appointment.
And, I know.
They would have had majority committees, and they could have unleashed Rand Paul and Fauci, and it would have been something to watch. But
we wouldn't, though. I mean, I don't want to sound an absurd minority here, but we wouldn't have realized just how terrible the Democrats are. If they hadn't controlled the Senate, they wouldn't really take the Tompkins out of the guns and show us what a left-wing party it is, in my opinion. Now, it's a terrible price to pay for that, and the voters missed their chance.
They sure did.
But 2 years was a long enough demonstration.
Yeah, they should have reacted better.
They should have understood. And
if I may, in slightly Spenglerian terms here, what really distresses me is when you get right down to it, even though to an extent the 2020 presidential election was rigged, even though there were a lot of factors, as we've mentioned, involved in the midterms, the fact is, two elections in a row, the country's preferred Biden to Trump. And just looking at America, it scares the hell out of me that that electorate, which I think historically has usually done the right thing of the choices in front of it, would have done that. I mean, that any country could actually seriously put Biden ahead of Trump. It really seriously depresses me.
Well, there's two things going on that I don't think the Republicans understand. With the onset of globalization, if you look at the Fortune 400 and you look at those fortunes, out of the 400, I would say 350 are left wing now. And when you look at the zip codes of the most affluent counties in the United States, they all are all blue, especially here in California. The wealthier, the per capita income, the more. So what I'm getting at is, not only do they have a better grassroots, but they have so much more money at their disposal. And then there's another thing. And we've never had 13 or 14% of the population that was not born in the United States. We have 50 million people, and they're not being assimilated and integrated with civic education like they used to. And when they come here, they're not coming with, in the case of a few people from India or South Korea, but the majority are not coming with high school diplomas. Even they're coming destitute. They need federal subsidies in education, housing, legality, healthcare, etc. And they vote. I mean, when you talk about the Hispanic vote, it's not just the Hispanic vote. It's the Hispanic vote over 50 and second to third generation is going Republican.
Right.
But all of the first generation and young Hispanics, they're all voting still left wing.
All right. Let me interject here. You're right. Two things. I said to Claude before we got on, I said, we'll talk to Victor and Conrad, and I know I'll feel better after I do that. Yeah. And I'm not feeling any better, guys. Okay. So buck me up. And then furthermore, I need a lift because I said the other day on the radio, they said, what's gone wrong with the country? I said, it's my fault. It is my fault. I was the damn Secretary of Education. I screwed it up, I guess, you know, I mean, I don't think I did, but, you know, back to what you were saying, assimilation, curriculum, schools are a mess. I mean, civics, social study, I call it history. They want to call it civics and social studies. Most of the stuff our kids are being taught is just perfect primers. For what we're seeing in terms of people becoming Democrats.
Well, it's anti-Americanism, isn't it? I mean, aren't they being taught to dislike their country?
Yes, they are. And that their country is a colonial power.
I think the way to look at it, Bill, is when you were secretary in the 80s.
Yeah, Reagan, yeah.
Yeah, that was 80s, early 90s was World War One, and it was the standoff. We stopped them. And then there was the appeasement in the interwar period, and now we're in World War II. Okay. And this is an existential war with them.
Okay.
And I think we can win it as we did World War II. But
you don't think I should feel personally responsible?
No, not at all. I think everybody thought, I mean, you guys thought
your best.
We thought Jesse Jackson, you know, prancing around Stanford saying, hey, hey, ho, ho. Western Civ's got to go, and demonizing Bloom and Bello and you. But that thing was stopped for a while. And, you know, we got in the George Bush. And
well, I went to Stanford and gave that speech in defense of Western Civ. Do you remember that?
I do. I was teaching there as a visitor.
I wanted President Kennedy, who was president of the university then, to be there. And he was in Washington. You know, it's like appointment Samara.
He didn't end up well, so that means anything.
I remember going and giving my speech and then waiting for the faculty, a bunch of smart people, to devour me. And they didn't. They sent up students to ask very timid questions. Mm-hmm. And my speech was, you know, Western civilization has its problems, but compared to others, it's pretty damn good, you know.
We're way beyond that at Stanford now. I mean, you couldn't.
Oh, no, I know. I know.
You wouldn't be
I
able to speak. So my point is that it's.
Do you know who the editor of the Stanford conservative paper was then?
Then who was it?
Yeah, a guy who founded PayPal.
Peter Thiel.
Yeah, he was the editor of the paper.
Yeah,
and then he came and he was an intern for me at my department, and I didn't know it. If I'd known it, I would have asked him for a couple of stock tips, but you know. Teal was there, and he said, I was there. I was worshipful of you and your grand speech and all that. I said, damn it, Teal, you could have given me some help here otherwise. But
I think
it's a different time.
The globalization really created an Eastern and Western coast elite with a magnitude of money. I mean, when you look at the corridor between San Jose and San Francisco, you got $7 trillion of market capitalization in Apple and Google, Facebook, Twitter, all of those places. Yeah. That's never happened before. And then if you look at the politicians, it used to be run by people all over the state, but California is a private domain of Nancy Pelosi, the former Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Jerry Brown, Gavin Newsom, Kamala. All of these politicians came out of that, and they were all backed by huge amounts of money. And then look at Stanford University. Stanford, they gave us Elizabeth Holmes and the Theranos. They gave us the Bankman-Fried family, that both the professor parents and Sam. They gave us this Ellison woman that was running Alameda, his diversionary company. And even the president of Stanford is under investigation now. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a weird coalescence of globalized money, hard left politics. But it used to be that when you saw a Democrat, they were suspicious of wealth and they were populist. And now they are the establishment. They're the party with wealth. They don't believe in the First Amendment. They used to defend. They're not. They don't believe in free speech areas. They don't believe in integration. They still believe
in tax breaks for themselves, though.
Yes. For the elite, they believe that none of their the consequences of their ideology never apply to themselves.
I mean, the rich people in Wall Street are no better, Victor. I mean,
they're the same.
It's complete hypocrisy. They get a really favored treatment on the way they run these private equity firms.
When Bill was talking about being education secretary, there was something of diverse opinion in professional sports. Hollywood had some conservative actors. The corporate boardroom was not all left. There were some foundations that were conservative that had, you know, some sway compared to liberal foundations. The K through 12, there were school boards that were reasonable, but they've taken over all those institutions.
When I was young, all the great sports stars were veterans of World War II. Yeah, Ted Williams was head of sports for Nixon in 1960.
But liberals that we used to grow up with on TV, John Chancellor, the Huntley-Brinkley report, Walter, they were all left wing, but they had a patina of, I don't know, disinterested fairness. I'm not saying they always were.
David Brinkley, I knew well. He wasn't such a lefty. Walter was hopeless. I agree. But David Brinkley was all right.
But compare that with what we have now.
Yeah.
And this is not even talking about this electronic instant, you know, Twitter and Facebook that we on the right never really mastered. that was kind of a cool spinoff.
Won't there be a reaction to this? I don't mean a reaction. Won't there be, in that vast country of a third of a billion people, aren't there scores of millions of people silently saying to themselves, wait a minute, where are we?
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, you know, they're doing, they're yeah. not, what they're doing is you talk to them, they're irate and they're half the country, but you know what they're doing? They're just, they say things like, I haven't watched the Super Bowl halftime in 10 years. I do not watch the NBA. Yeah, I have not gone to a Hollywood movie in a theater in ages. Yeah, I have not turned on network news. They're dropping out. They have a alternative cultures.
They were treating to a,
look at
to
CNN. A private they just place. They don't watch.
They're treating from the public space.
They do. They're not getting galvanized to get back in there and take back the culture. They've forfeited it, and they're making alternative cultures, but they're not yet politically.
That's where Trump almost. Viable. There. I mean, he did reach a lot of those people, but then he did a lot of
them. He did.
Sure.
He did. That was what his great contribution was, those rallies and all those people that were forgotten. But I think too many of them feel that I just don't want. I know so many families that have young men that are between the ages of 25 and 35, kind of date, kind of don't date, kind of work, kind of don't work, kind of live at home, kind of don't, directionless. Turned off. I don't know what's wrong with them, but they're dropouts from the culture. And they listen to Joe Rogan. They listen to Ben Shapiro. They listen to Jordan Peterson, but they're not back into the culture and galvanize and say, you know what? We're going to vote and form we're going to join Charlie Kirk and all this stuff. They're just, that hasn't happened yet. And maybe it will. Yeah. Things are going to get really bad. That's what I'm worried about next 2 years. I mean, this inflation recession is not over.
Bad enough to get people out of their retreat, their safe places.
I think it's going to get really bad. And I think their emphasis on race is so, it's such a fixation that it's starting to really alienate people. And it's because it's blatantly racist. And I think that's bothering people. The crime in the major cities and the homelessness and this sheer unlivability.
It's horrifying. My wife's going to New York in a couple of days, and she's taking, she won't carry a handbag. She's taking a money belt. You know, so it'll be hard to steal her money.
That's smart.
She's not living in Harlem or anything. You know, I mean, she'll be in Manhattan, in a good part of Manhattan.
Yeah, I just think that it's on that they've rendered a lot of places in America unlivable. California is completely dysfunctional. So I think a lot of people are going to have to. Somebody's going to have the ability to appeal to these dropouts and say, get back in and take back your country, or you're not going to have a country.
You see, that's one area where DeSantis isn't as good as Trump. I mean, Trump, in his screwball way, was sort of an inspiring leader at times.
Yeah, he was.
DeSantis he's an ordinary man who's done well and has got a lot going for him. He's been a very good governor, but he's not an inspiring character. I don't
know. And that's what we're going to have to learn during the primaries when we get on the debate, because I thought maybe you would disagree with me, but I remember in 2016 that Scott Walker was the ideal governor. He'd been in a purple state. He took on the teacher.
Right.
When he got on that debate stage, he was devoured by Trump.
Yeah.
And he was a good man and he was a good governor, but
he's sort of colorless, huh?
Yeah. And I hope DeSantis doesn't prove to be that way when he gets on the stage.
We'll see. I mean, the office makes you bigger too. It does make you bigger, and it can. And I think, I thought Scott Walker was kind of the perfect, kind of candidate. But boy, he was out fast.
He was out fast.
I think DeSantis is stronger stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows how it carries? But can we agree that the next 2 years will be horrible, and maybe
can we agree that if that is the case, that really should? I mean, the Republicans will have to try hard to lose if that's the case. I mean, they'll really have to try hard to lose. Am I wrong?
Senate races are, would lean our way next time as opposed to this way. You know, they got to defend more seats.
I just wish there was somebody in a position of leadership in the House, a majority leader, a minority leader or whatever, or the RNC chairman that says, trust me, we're going to raise more money and I'll show you how than they do. And we're going to solve this don't show up on election day ballot. And we're going to work on every state legislature that we can. We're going to go to court when we must, but we're going to return Election Day to mean something, and we're going to outraise the Democrats. But nobody even says that. I guess they've given up.
I think there are some, but they're not, you know, the first word you said, Victor, they're not in that leadership position. It's not McConnell. It's not McCarthy. It's not McDaniel, three Scots people, as you said. But there are some very able people in the Senate and in the House. But, you know, they're not in commanding positions.
No, but Bill, you know,
positions where they can rally the country.
If you could name the next party chairman who would do the kind of thing that Victor just said, who would it be? Shooting from the hip.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
Lee Zeldin has been mentioned, hasn't he? I don't know how much. Is he running against McDaniel? I think he is, or supposed to.
Is he?
No. Yeah, I think he's been mentioned, but I just don't think that they're, I don't know. They seem like a deer in the headlights. They're so baffled by what's happened to the country and the mechanisms by which the left used COVID to completely redefine how we vote in America without even an amendment or a national discussion. They just did it under the cloak of COVID, and they were ready to take advantage of that. And then the way they raise money is just, I always thought, you know, dark money. Jane Meyer writes all these books about dark money. Well, nothing has been darker than Mark Zuckerberg putting $419 million into the 2020 election to warp these precincts. Or
he's saying quite a hit financially, though.
Yeah, Bankman-Fried.
I think we should recognize we've scored a huge victory with Elon Musk. I mean,
I was going to ask you, how long does he last?
Well, I'm worried about him. I'm worried about his health and safety.
Yeah, I am too. How do they take him down?
Well, they despise him because he's
right.
He was,
so what do they do?
Them.
Is he the world's wealthiest man right now? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so he's okay. So how do they get him?
If he
that
loses,
fraud, what are they going to do? They're going to do something, right?
Well, you know, we had that meeting with Tim Cook, and Tim Cook is the one, along with Google and Amazon, they absolutely destroyed Parler by denying them access to their apps.
Yeah.
And they had 20 million people ready to sign up, and they just deflated that effort. But when people
Cook met with Musk, he said he wouldn't take him down.
Yeah,
right?
And I think that's because he's dealing with somebody who's A, the richest man in the world, and B, is capable of a lot of things. I mean, have we ever seen an American that's leading our space effort or reinvented the electric vehicle in a way that GM and Toyota couldn't? And he's got all of these. He's really does something. He's not just cyber this and tech that. He's material. He does something, and he's very capable, and he's unpredictable. And he's fearless.
He's siring children out of wedlock in Canada. He's building up the white birthright. No one complains about it. It's amazing.
No, he's I don't know. I think he's very, they don't know how to get rid of him. They want to get rid of him any way possible, but they
don't
know.
Does he have private security? I hope he does.
He said the other day he was no longer going to sign autographs in public spaces because of the security problem.
Sure. Sure.
But are you guys afraid that he's going to lose his investment? I mean, obviously, Twitter was a house of cards. And you've got to wonder if it's worth $40 billion. Now, it's not all his money, but assumedly, he can afford whatever's coming.
Yeah, he's worth $200 billion. But a lot of that's in Tesla stock and other things. But I've been looking at the traffic and the new signups, and the left is completely wrong about that. They're getting really robust people joining Twitter. People are not leaving Twitter like they said they were.
Yeah.
And the irony about it is it's really true. Trump had this Truth Social that was supposed to rival an evil Twitter. But when Twitter flips, then the reason to be of Truth Social becomes less cogent.
Well, isn't that where Nunes is now?
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about, because I like Devin Nunes. Yeah. He's very capable.
Well, why doesn't Trump merge the two and send Nunes back to be your congressman?
You're talking about selflessness again.
Yeah,
which
I don't
is
know.
Not of all the things Trump's displayed, selflessness is not one of them.
I just thought that what I'm worried about is that because I know him and I'm prejudiced because I've liked him and I've seen him. He's about the only honest person I've ever met in politics, because for all those years and all that exposure to big money, he lives in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house about 20 miles from me. And he's got a wife who's a primary school teacher, 3 wonderful daughters. He's completely honest. He has no hidden bank account. And he's a man of, you know, limited means, because he devoted his life to politics, and he fights, and he's very smart. And right now, a guy like that would be invaluable at Ways and Means or at running the Republican Party or something like that.
Well, then he should be party chairman.
Yeah, but he's in a situation where he's very vulnerable, because this Truth Social, there's so many things happening with that genre of social media. Not that it does more than just Twitter stuff, but when Twitter kind of is flipped and it doesn't offer the alternative that it did before, because Twitter will now tell conservatives, you can just come to us and we're not going to censor you. And that's
so time for him to become party chairman, isn't it? Isn't that the upshot of this meeting?
Sure, that's fine. That's fine. That's a very good candidate. Other people come to mind? Who are the people you like, admire? Well,
what do you think of Carmine Dillon? She's a candidate, isn't she?
Is she a candidate or something?
She is. I'm not sure that a lawyer, you know what I mean, without political experience is the right person.
Yes.
Yeah, I like to see somebody that is either run for office or work, but she's a very good lawyer. I like her a lot. I met her and know her a little bit.
Oh, she's great. Yeah. She's running for what? For RNC?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yeah. That's what she's been meant. Yeah. She said that on Fox News the other night. She's going to run for the RNC.
RNC chairmanship. Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think you need somebody. I don't know.
What do you like? What do you like in the House and Senate? Who do you like?
For that type of job?
Not for leadership, for
the
passing the TV, you stop and pause because the person might have something really good to say.
I agree with you. Every time I see Tom Cotton, I get impressed by him.
He's so smart. He's
smart, and he understands the left so well.
Holly's pretty good, isn't he, from Missouri?
Yeah, I like him, too. They've really tried to demonize him and destroy him, but he's everybody thought Ron Johnson was a crank. The more I listen to him, the more prescient he's.
He's not very good. He's a courageous man.
He is a courageous man. And everything he said turned out to be true.
And he's a winner, too.
He won. He won a difficult race. I really admire him. And he's unapologetic. I like that. And so he's another good. They have very good people in the Senate. They have very good candidates running for president. What I don't understand is how they win the aggregate vote, midterm vote, by 3 or 4 million votes nationwide. More people voted for Republican than Democratic candidates at the state and federal level. And they don't transfer that into the type of usual 20 seat pickup or 2 or 3 Senate pickup. They don't transfer that. It just doesn't. Something's wrong.
Why isn't that? Because we have an overabundance in the Red South and elsewhere. And
are the candidates? I don't know. Are the issues? Or we never had a national unifying message? You know, one thing I think the greatest thing Newt Gingrich ever did in 1994. Nobody had ever done that. And everybody said, you don't do that because you give away your message and then they have time to nitpick it. But that was a brilliant idea. And they never really repeated
that. And they swept the Congress on that.
Yeah, they did. It was really good. And so they need something like that at a national to galvanize. They were very good in getting good candidates, some of the good candidates. At the House level, those New York candidates were very good. The California candidates, I think they even picked up one seat in California. They all won that were supposed to, you know, that were had, they were won here where I am. I think 4 of them won in Orange County, 2 or 3 of them won, and they were in plus Democratic districts.
My ticket is DeSantis and either Cotton or Pompeo foreign policy.
I mean, I hate to sound like a Democrat here, but wouldn't we want someone like Tim Scott or something just to really shake the Democrats up a bit? I mean, the two guys you mentioned are fine, but don't you want a tactical choice for vice president?
Yeah, I used to think that, but, you know, you say Uncle Tom 100 times and people start to believe it.
I've heard him speak a lot. He's very good. He's
a great man, great human being.
Yeah. Real. It's a touching story, you know, a guy from really a long way down the well.
Yeah, I think No, I think they'll have someone. I think they won't, whether we like it or not, they won't have two white males on the ticket.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. But I, you know, the reason I mentioned Cotton and Pompeo is something we haven't talked about, and we're out of time. We'll do it on the next one. But, you know, we may be annihilated anyway by China and Russia coming together in North Korea. I mean, we just seem hopeless here. We are building up defense. We're throwing soldiers out because they won't get COVID tests. Do you see the Navy is, 10%?
Yeah.
Of its goal, reached 10% of its recruiting goal.
Army is only 50%.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And you can chalk that up to Mark. I think they give you all these different reasons why that's so, but the main reason is the elephant in the room, that when Mark Milley starts lecturing in Austin about white supremacy, and they're going to have all these woke stuff. And then you're telling that one demographic that south of the Mason-Dixon line and in the north in rural America, that generation after generation after generation, they go to Korea, they go to the first Gulf War, they go to Iraq, they go to Afghanistan. You tell them that they're suspect by this color of their skin, and they die at twice the numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan. 75% of all the fatalities were white males that represent 33% of the population. And you tell them that they're racist and they're not going to join. I talked to them.
Milley is a catastrophe.
If you were an advisor to Xi, wouldn't you whisper in his ear and say, they are so vulnerable right now. This is our moment.
I think they are, Bill. I think they're talking about Taiwan 24/7.
Yeah, but look, invading Taiwan would not be any day at the beach. I mean, not to make a terrible pun, but they, you know, the Taiwanese are armed to the teeth. They would fight like hell. And you're moving, you'd need 500,000 men. You'd have to move them at about 10 knots across three times the distance that Eisenhower had to cross to get to Normandy. And he had absolute command of the sea and the air. The Chinese could take a terrible hit on that if they tried.
Yeah, but we would take a terrible hit if we decided to protect them.
And would we?
Yeah, we would. I think if you put one of those $15 billion carriers in the South China Sea, it would be gone in an hour.
This is the other thing. I mean, where the hell, for all the money that Trump lavished on the Pentagon, why are the Nimitz-class carriers not defended? And why don't we have any hypersonic
missiles? I don't know. Why are we having this new B-21 that's going to cost $750 million per plane? And that's supposed to be the answer when we could make thousands of small drones, hundreds of thousands, millions of them, and just swarm the Chinese. I don't know these questions, but
the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we should not forget, is the person who told the Senate Armed Forces Committee that the Russians would have Kiev in 3 days and they'd have the whole country in 2 weeks. I mean, that's a triumph of military intelligence.
And then Afghanistan, remember, would not fall apart, as people said.
That's right. All right. On this happy note.
And this happy note.
All right, guys. We'll see. It's America. It's resilient. It always, what did Churchill say? They do the right thing after they've tried everything else.
But in those days, they usually came to the right thing before the British did. But by the way, if that's any comfort to you, all our other countries are shambles, too. It's a horrible mess in England. I just come back from that. I mean, it's just a disaster.
Okay, that does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to thebillbennettshow.com. Follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett. Like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share the podcast with your family and your friends. We'll catch up next week.